So, Kevin, I don't know if you know this, but Shane grew up with a rather interesting character. I don't say grew up with, but during his high school
A lot
years,
of interesting characters.
A lot of interesting
We've
characters.
We've already covered
Rat. One of which is remarkable for me because he's the one gentleman that I've never met, never heard, or never seen at all, but I can do an impression of him.
And it's pretty good.
Yeah. Hey, Snoots, we've got to go drink some Budweiser's. And then that would be Rudy. So Shane, why don't you tell us
Wait,
a little bit?
What did you say?
Yeah, it's hard to explain.
You have to actually.
You have
I'll tell you what. I'll
Rudy's.
I'll say what I said, and then I'll translate for you. But hey, Snoots,
hey,
let's go drink some Budweiser's. And it's hey, dudes. why don't we go get some Budweiser beers and consume them?
Oh,
I have so many wonderful stories about Rudy. But he was older than us. We were all in high school. And he had this awesome mullet, and when he talked, his mouth was always full of spit. I really remember that. Like for some reason, he always looked like he was about to drool on himself. But and he held his arms akimbo and gestured when he talked. But the first night that I ever met him, he went and bought us a beer. And on the way out, he's like, "Hey, dates," and then dropped the bag of beer, and it all broke, and he had to go back. I mean, that's how we met. But my two favorite memories of Rudy. He and Dean were best friends, and Dean came into a little money, and they were inseparable. And when Dean came into a little money, instead of buying a house with the money, with the inheritance, his mom went ahead and continued to live in the trailer that she was already living in with him, but bought him another trailer on the same plot so they could be together. And Rudy lived with Dean. Dean and Rudy decided to move to Austin for about 6 months. One time we came and visited, from Curvo, we came and visited Dean and Rudy, and we all went to the
and
club.
How far, just for the people who don't know, how far is Curvo from?
Oh, okay. It's about 90 miles.
Okay.
An hour and a half, 2 hour drive. But it's a town of 15,000, whereas at the time Austin was a town of 500,000. So big change from the trailer. Actually they lived in Ingram, which is a town of 900, but we all went out to the club except Rudy, and before we left, he's like, "Dane, I need the credit card dates." And he's like, "Why? We're about to go out." And he's like, "I need Budweiser's before the store closes so I have something for breakfast." And so he went to the store and got the Budweiser's, and he came back. And we opened the door, and he had passed out in front of the TV playing video games. And he realized we were there, and he jumped up in a full-on karate stance. But he didn't know karate. And my other favorite story about Rudy is after I had graduated high school and moved to Austin, went back to Kerrville for the summer, and Rudy was down there. He had moved back to his hometown, wherever the hell that was, and I think he was down there borrowing money from Dean. And he came to a party that we were all at, and another friend of a mutual friend of ours, Rudy's like, "All right, dates, I got to drive us back to San Antonio." Oh, and he S is on the end of everything.
Sure.
Dates, got to drive back to San Antonio.
Whether it was meant to be plural or not,
everything was S's.
Yeah.
And so Chris was like, "Rudy, are you okay to drive?" And Rudy's like, "Yeah, dude, I got a whole 12-pack ice down in the trunk." All right.
I have to say that unlike the film Rudy, that was not at all inspirational.
No. Wasn't the film Rudy, wasn't he mentally challenged? So there's two mentally challenged guys here.
Well,
so there may be
more parallels than we were thinking.
That's
a story for another time. Yeah.
All right. I'm Shane Bartell.
This is Ryan Newsom.
I'm Kevin Newsom.
This is Somebody Likes It, which the show where every week we take an album that somebody out there really likes, but we don't know that well, and then we ramble on about it for an hour. Is that safe to say?
That's safe to
and
say.
Have a couple drinks.
Oh, yeah, a couple drinks in there, too. All right, Kevin, roll.
All right, let's do it. So we're back for another week. This, again, is Kevin Newsom. We're going to talk a little bit tonight, or today, or whenever it is that you pull this up, about an album that I never got around to connecting with, but it seems like all of the rest of America did in their own weird way, and
suburbia did anyway.
Yeah, certainly some of it. And we're going to talk about NWA's Straight Outta Compton.
That's right.
So so anyway, I wanted to start with a little blurb. You know, I found it like there's tons that's been written on this record, and then one of the things that I thought was particularly interesting is this is another one of those albums that, in particular, like a lot of especially online magazines that want to maintain music magazines that want to maintain street cred will go back and re-review this like years after it's been out.
That's interesting.
Yeah, no, it's totally true.
Well, and people are really hot and cold about it,
and they go back and remaster it and re-release it here and there. So there are different variations of it floating around, I have found.
Well, Pitchfork in particular is particularly adept at doing this kind of thing where they just, you know, whatever, find religion on a particular record years after it's come out. And in this case, like, it's a pretty interesting review, but I'll read you just a few sentences of their, like, a snippet of what they put together. And it kind of sets up some of the way that I look at this record.
Before you get into that, I want to briefly comment on the fact that we're back in the garage.
We are back in the garage. The chalice is in full effect.
The chalice is in effect.
There are two chalices.
There's a wine chalice.
There's a wine chalice. Ryan's rocking. Do you rock the wine chalice? How does that work?
Yes. I'm going to rock the mic wine chalice.
Yeah. Well, and
in the Bill Haley sense of the term?
I think he rocked around the clock.
Right, right, right. But in that, you know, or you in or the Stray Cats, yes, yes, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there are chalices.
Chali?
Chali.
Chalin?
I don't know.
I will say one thing about the aviary last week.
Had air conditioning.
It sure was cooler in there.
Yeah. No, sorry. This is my punishment to Shane for making us listen to that record last week.
Bon Jovi.
I decided to sweat him down to bones and a head.
Oh, that's trust me, yeah.
We're going to truly be slippery when wet tonight.
It's going to – I already am slippery. It's going to be a few weeks before I get around to something that's going to torture you guys again after sitting in the garage again.
All right. Yeah. Well, it's the least I could do.
Thank you, Kevin.
So let me circle back to this Pitchfork review. And it goes a little bit – this excerpt goes a little bit something like this. And I think it's pretty interesting the way it's characterized. He says, in some ways, Straight Outta Compton is the archetypical rap album, the one you would send into space if you wanted to ignite a stellar holocaust. It unites the paranoia of It Takes a Nation of Millions with the chill of The Chronic while still retaining an old-school Run DMC-style playfulness. And I think that's true. The opening squall of Straight Outta Compton, Fuck the Police, and Gangsta Gangsta is still as confrontational and decimating as it was at the dawn of the 1990s. This review, it should be noted again, was written years after the fact.
When was it written?
2008, maybe.
Very
like,
recently. Yeah,
reasonably recently. The bass still throttles the funk combust, and the sirens deafen as Eazy-E dispenses with the tired romantic cliches. So what about a bitch you got shot, fucker? You think I give a damn about a bitch? I ain't no sucker. And this is the least misogynistic of NWA's albums. So it was really a long setup to read the last line, but but I mean, but it's, you know, it's clear, and it was good to like rip off like a Band-Aid the record that we covered last week. But I do think this is one of these that it was a seminal record, and you know, I have spent a lot of time this week thinking about the fact that part of what, aside from talent, part of what makes famous people famous is their willingness to do and say things that the general populace won't find
outrageous, too.
Yeah. And so I think this record is kind of an example of that.
That's a great example, especially if you look at I want to comment on this real quick. I love how in that review – whoever wrote it drops in the comparison to It Takes a Nation of Moons to Hold Us Back. And that we were just talking about this right before we started recording, Ryan and I were, how much similarity musically I found. And I had never thought of this before, but with Public
before
Enemy
last
and
night
NWA.
We were like 12 beers in or whatever.
Well, yeah, well, it's been made since then and it holds up today.
You do have a point.
Truth is truth, my friend.
I should note that Shane called me at like 2:30 in the morning with a very urgent matter to discuss the parallels between Straight Outta Compton and Welcome to the Terror Dome by Public Enemy.
It was very important at the time.
Well, and you know, I think what and I have I've actually not read that exact comparison, but I've read similar comparisons, and one of the things that one reviewer noted that I also agree with was specifically when it comes to Public Enemy, their bombast is so often steeped in like historical context
and politics and
So it's the way that they go about that is different, and it was like Ice Cube just wanted to punch you in the face. Like that's he's like I don't care what the history is, like if you fit in this box, like you're going down and there's going to be yellow tape around.
Well, I like that you're talking about people that become famous, their willingness to do stuff that normal people won't, or I'm saying people that they do outrageous, attention-getting things. Sure. And I think that there's such an element of showmanship to that stuff, especially when, in relation to that, if you consider Ice Cube's latter career. We'll read some of Ice Cube's lyrics. He wrote
Look up his IMDb profile.
He wrote over half of the lyrics on Straight Outta Compton, but now he's better known. Well, these days he's better known by a generation of children who have gone and seen Are We There Yet? And Are We There Yet 2? And all of those. He's a teddy bear now.
Well, yeah, he totally is. And he's rich.
And this is coming. And by the way,
several of these guys are moguls now.
That's coming. And that's what's happened to the man that wrote Do I look like a motherfucking role model to a kid looking up to me? Life ain't nothing but bitches and money.
Well, and this is specifically that last phrase is one of the ones that's made it.
By the way, could that be said any wider than the way it was just than I just uttered that? Life ain't nothing but bitches.
Well,
and money.
And that
money
reminds me of a couple of things. The first one is that
true that Shane.
I can't true that.
I almost spit beer in your face.
One is that I couldn't like go through all this stuff without thinking that this is like going to be the Herbert Kornfeld of the white accounts receivable guy for The Onion that used to write. So it was always about the receivables with lots of
receivable.
Z's. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, I was like, okay, well, this is definitely going to be that. But then when I'm listening to the record on an unnamed streaming service, they put ads in the middle. And so, like, you listen to a few songs, and then
I encountered the same thing.
And then,
Completely takes you out of it because it's like a Bank of America ad or some crap.
It's like an auto parts store that had like this cheery.
Oh, it was when it was O'Reilly's. Yeah.
Life ain't nothing but bitches and money. O'Reilly's.
Like, get out of here, man! You're gonna get shot. It's really dangerous for those guys. But they just wander in happily to the narrative. Like, it was no big thing. So, anyway.
They may need to do some research on their demographics.
Yeah, circling back to Shane's original thought there, like, life ain't nothing but bitches and money. That's one of the things that, like, just made its way into the lexicon that came out of this record. And you think, oh, well, that's that, like, as cultural touchstones go, when those things just filter their way in.
Oh, man, that shit cannot be overstated.
Yeah.
I mean, their contribution to rap music or the culture in general, or at least for a period of time, they were so integral to that. But, you know, even now, that ethos is still penetrating popular music and popular culture, albeit in a more outrageous way. That was another thing too about listening to this is that shit's pretty outrageous, but it's completely mainstream in so many ways now.
Well, I my first experience with this record, and I never heard it all the way through, but I certainly heard like Fuck the Police, and it was when like me and my friends would be out just being knuckleheads on the weekend, you know, like going somewhere and drinking beers or whatever, and somebody would throw this cassette on and like, you know, their 15-inch Rockford Fosgate speakers would be just banging the crap out of their truck or whatever. And
that sounds suspiciously like my childhood.
Yeah.
Well, all the kids go to park in a parking lot.
And so we just thought it was like some fucking crazy-ass shit. And now when I listen to it, it sounds like a like cultural relic, you know?
But it sounds comical to me. Well, I mean, there was intentional comedy in a lot of but
sure. More than once they refer to their dicks as like, what is it, like Dingle Dangle or something, like real silly shit.
Is it Dingle Dangle?
Yeah, like,
It's like a brand of popcorn. I don't know what that is.
I'm sitting here reading all the lyrics from Gangsta Gangsta, which is the funniest song on this album, and I think the most quotable. And there's I keep wanting to laugh the whole time. My man Dre will fuck you up in a minute with the right, left, you're toothless. Then they say, God damn, they ruthless. It's so funny.
Well, and one of the other things I noticed right away is that this, like the album artwork, also strikes the, it's like, so we talked a little bit about this when we did the Beastie Boys stuff, like that sort of like looking down upon the subject, like you're,
well, no, I think it's supposed to be look like you just got curb
shot.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. It's like this, except this is worse. You might be dead. Yeah. So. Or apparently, yeah, and they're still mad at you. Like you're dead and you're down, and they're all
take
looking
that
at you,
motherfucker.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, yeah.
Hey, you know what we should do? Well, why don't we go ahead and throw in a clip?
Yeah, let's. In fact, let's start with. I think it'd be great to start with the most iconic song from this record. And let's go down the title track. Let's start with Straight Outta Compton.
Yeah, let's listen to that.
Straight Outta Compton.
47 is a tool. Don't make me act a motherfucking fool. Toe-to-toe, no make. I'm knocking niggas out the box daily. Yo, weekly, monthly, yearly. Until them dumb motherfuckers see clearly that I'm down with the capital CBT. Boy, you can't fuck with me. So when I'm in your neighborhood, you better duck. Cause Ice Cube is crazy as fuck. As I leave, believe I'm starving. But when I come back, boy, I'm coming straight out of Compton.
What's up?
Tell them where you're from.
Straight out of Compton. Another crazy ass nigga. When punks I smoke, yo, my rep gets bigger. I'm a bad motherfucker and you know this. But the pussy ass niggas won't show this. But I don't give a fuck, I'ma make my snaps. If not from the records, from jacking a crap, just like burglary. The definition is jacking. But when illegally armed, it's gonna pack it. Shoot a motherfucker in a minute. I'll find a good piece of pussy and go up in it. So if you had a show in the front row, I'ma call you a bitch or a dirty ass.
And we've been successfully removed from Compton. Welcome, everybody. We're outside of Compton.
And we're back on the set of the Lawrence Welk show.
And wonderful. You might not have noticed this. We took a direct route. We went straight. We didn't wind around. Nobody was walking in. It's like, well, this is as if to underscore my pastiness. I always tell people that some people, when I'm talking about rap, that if I ever designed...
Just those nameless, people. Faceless people.
That if I ever designed a golf course, that it would look like a honey bun if you flew over the top of it, because it would have to accommodate the way I hit the ball. So it'd just be a big concentric circle to the right. Anyway, nothing having to do with South Central L.A. Still... crazy that song.
Where are you going with that?
I think I might have just
let him keep going.
You know, how far along I might have just unraveled that one. Yeah.
I will say this about your impending stand-up career. Going good so far?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Well, right now it's a sit-down career.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, no.
You got to try out material somehow, though.
Circling back, all goofy situation aside, like, I do think that, like, that's a song that it really sounds as new today as it
I
did
love that song. It yeah. sounds so good.
And I found myself one, and I'm sure that this information is out there, and I just didn't find it, or I didn't look very hard for this particular snippet. But I wonder, like, mostly I wonder about Ice Cube, because he's the one who sort of lyrically he leads the charge on, like, I'm going to be up in specifically. Cops, I'm going to be in your face, and you're going down, and I'm the guy who's going to do it to you. And he's like, he's pretty straightforward about it. So, like, it's true. Think about when this came out, and, like, I know the groundswell that came from it, but I wonder about individually sort of how his, if that changes the worldview at all, or maybe not. I don't know.
I tend to take a little more cynical view. These guys were, and are, really astute businessmen.
But they really were living... I mean, in
I'm not trying to take anything away from the fact that they came from, you know, life on the streets or whatever, but, like, when you look at, like, sort of the backstory of this record, I mean, Eazy-E owned Ruthless Records, and they had multiple platinum albums, not just NWA, but other artists as well. Like, he had an 80% stake in that deal, and
he also got the AIDS and died.
He did get the AIDS, and he fathered seven children by six different women, so I guess it's not mutually exclusive that you can be, you know, selling drugs. And he got his money to invest in Ruthless from selling drugs.
Well, that and his partner was an older, savvy, somewhat wealthy
Hebrew gentleman.
Jewish man, yes. I don't know why that matters, but...
For some reason in the music business, they do really well.
Music, movies.
Ultimately, like, I think the interesting... Well, there are a few things about Eazy-E that are really interesting, not the least of which is the fact that because he's the guy that died in 1995, he's the one that, like, in a weird way, like, I think he sort of cements the staying power of this act because of the whole thing about, like, there's that whole, like, you die young and then people form their opinion of, like, what that was.
At that point.
Yeah, it's set in stone. And I did find what he was worth, what his estate is worth today. And
it's been picked apart by his heirs.
Yeah, no, I'm sure that. Well, I take that back. It's actually what he was worth at the time that he died.
Okay,
and that was $8 million, which sounds like it's a tidy sum.
Yeah.
Until you think about the fact that like Dre just sold Beats to Apple, and that guy's a billionaire.
A billionaire.
He is literally a billionaire.
So he's got to have the biggest house in Compton.
I'm sure I just raised a whole block and just built
that like a reverse Beverly Hillbillies kind of thing.
It's on hydraulics. Like just I don't know.
Oh, and by the way, gentlemen, I did discover what is the exact opposite of NWA. So I may have explained
white guys without attitudes.
Well, no, in a sense, yes. There's a little bit of a long tail to this kite, and pardon me for paraphrasing Spade, but anyway, so I had a bitch of a time trying to stream this. I finally found like a full version of it online that I could listen to on my laptop, but I have a new 56-year-old roommate. It's like rooming with Dad, Kevin.
Awesome.
And he was trying to take a nap this afternoon, so I was trying to listen to this record in the next room with an older middle-aged man trying to sleep next to me, and It's not easy. And plus, I also really wanted to listen to this in the car, which is how I experienced it as a youth.
Sure.
A young knucklehead. A ute.
Is that something your grandma says?
No, that's
your mom, I mean.
That's Joe Pesci from...
That's a Northeastern colloquialism.
I don't know.
Anyhow, I really wanted to listen to it all like in the car. So I was able to kind of cobble together like a set list of the album in its running order, but I'd have to like... go back and look at it and reload it on a site and whatever. And I was almost through with the entire album, and I just couldn't get find the last one online to stream. So I went straight from that back to the radio, and who was on but Garrison Keillor on NPR reading a Robert Frost poem.
And which that is clearly the same thing.
That is a white guy without attitude, if ever there was one. Reading a white guy without attitude,
from Lake Wobegon.
I don't even know what to do with that. That's
I was like, yep, this is as far away from NWA as you can get.
What were you saying earlier about the travails and of attempting to listen to?
Man, okay, so this record must be a hot property because there's a version of it online where the guy's like, hey, sorry, EMI was giving me crap and I had to take down the audio of a couple of them. And then I was also trying to listen to it on Spotify and...
on your phone?
Yes, I was trying to listen to it on Spotify on my phone, and apparently they want you to pay for the full subscription. I just haven't done it, and I'll get around to it. But anyway, it wouldn't play it in order, and so it just kept throwing up random versions of it, some of which were scrubbed clean. So I heard the same song back-to-back. I think it was Gangsta Gangsta, and it was like, you know, the full filthy fucking version, and then it was one that like half the lyrics were just gone.
I would love it if the clean version of Gangsta Gangsta, like every time there was like every time one of the words that they took out, it was just they came back in with somebody's like completely effectless voice.
Well, yeah. You know that there is a that came close to happening, which is that the movie Friday.
Yes, Ice Cube was in that.
Yes, Ice Cube was in that.
I went.
And the Alamo Draft House here in town, here in Austin, headquartered here in Austin, but now they're all over the country. Actually, did a thing celebrating I don't know, the 20th anniversary of that movie coming out, or the 25th anniversary, one or the other. And they reached out to the city of Los Angeles. And one of the things that they'll actually do from time to time is they do this rolling road show where they bring like a big inflatable screen, and they show movies in the places that they were, where they were created, or that in the areas where that they, that are sort of the,
yeah,
logistical, the rolling road show.
My ex producer professor was one of the principals behind that.
Yeah, so they'll show them like where in the places that they were, that they're about. So they were going to do, they were going to do the movie Friday. So they reached out to the city of LA and they said, "Hey, we want to show the movie Friday in LA, and we'll bring all the stuff out, and like we just want a place to put it up." And Los Angeles said no. And so basically what LA came back with was that they said that the content of the movie was not suitable for viewing for the general population. And so the Alamo Drafthouse got a little bit of a bee in their bonnet about censorship, and like sort of the, like one of the things that makes that movie unique is like the fact that it's set in that particular part of LA. And so anyway, they recut that movie. And every time there's a like an F-bomb or whatever, they just dubbed it in with like the whitest guy. Like,
darn.
That's exactly what I want.
That's exactly what happened. And I went and saw it. And it was like, it's a, you know, it's an hour and a half, it's a 90-minute movie. And it's really funny for about the first 25 minutes.
Like, you're like, yeah, I kind of get this.
But it was great. And I think they served like white bread. And it's just, it was... it was touch and go. But anyway, that's, I do think that this is, it's one of the things that's a like sort of a humorous byproduct of this record, and things that are about South Central at that time is like, it was a really serious deal, and to sort of cope with it or deal with it, or at the very least, like Americans are always, we're always going to find a way to poke fun a little bit.
It's true. So yeah, I do, Shane, I do think it would be a blast if we could, you know, take lyrics like "a crazy motherfucker from the street" and just replace it with "my fellow neighbor."
I'll be like, "My man Dre, mess you up in a minute."
Yeah, it's, I mean, it would sort of be hard to sell the radio edit of that, I think, but
why don't you get on that for me, and I'll go ahead and make the cut.
Well, you know what? Let's do this. Let's while we're talking about it, let's play the only song on this record that was a single that didn't have
curse words. And I guarantee you this was on purpose.
You think?
That there's not, I mean, with the rest of it's just riddled with,
I think he's being sarcastic, Ryan.
Them swear words.
Yeah.
the cursing.
We say cuss around these parts.
All right, so we'll, let's, and for those of you who don't know, we'll make this one a little bit of a surprise. Here you go. The only song on this record without cursing.
Even if Yella makes it a cappella, I still express, yo, I don't smoke weed or cess, cause it's known to give a brother brain damage, and brain damage on the mic don't manage nothing but making a sucker in you equal. Don't be another sequel.
Spread the snail. Spread the snail.
And we're back. Expressing.
Yes.
Expressing ourselves.
Well, they're expressing themselves. I thought one of the things that was really funny about that track is like, it sort of seems like the flip side of the coin, or the antithesis of some of the other things that are on this record. Like, it talks about, like, you know, that you can't flow. Like, if you're on drugs,
I don't smoke weed or assess because it's known to give a brother brain damage, and brain damage on the mic don't manage nothing.
Yeah, like
it's the exact opposite. It's the exact antithesis.
Well, it's
of every
it's
other
the radio single.
It is. It's totally the radio.
But you know what? It's the radio single. But also, you have to think about it at that time, like the predominant form, or that rap was taking, that was the most popular, you know, in 88, 89, was that really Afrocentric stuff, Tribe Called Quest, to some degree, of course,
which you mentioned,
Public Enemy.
what you mentioned before was like really more jazz based and like
jazz based, but Diggable Planets. They came a little bit later, but that's similar form of stuff. Yeah, mm-hmm. So message, but it was real message oriented, and that song kind of seems radio single, yes, but it also seems like an attempt to do that message oriented stuff.
Well, and then you hear things like. Like the throwaway line about that mentioned subject and predicate, and I was like, I was like, you guys are just putting on. Like, you know exactly what you're doing. You know exactly what you're doing.
Some savvy motherfuckers, man.
Yeah, no, absolutely, solid. By the way, one thing that we haven't talked about is that the NWA movie is going into production.
True. Like, and I just sort of saw allusions to it in my looking up this record, so you guys may know a little bit more about it. I don't know who's cast as leads or, you know.
Ice Cube's kid is going to play
Ice Cube.
They're
all pretty much unknowns.
Well, Ice Cube's kid is going to play Ice Cube. The guy that's playing, I think Eazy-E is a relative unknown. And
which one is Josh Hartnett going to be?
Yes, Josh Hartnett.
you guys got to hear. You got to. Since you're talking about it, I'm gonna find it here. And
one thing that I pulled. Oh, you got something you want to go through?
No, go ahead and talk. I'll find this
one
in
thing
a minute.
that ties into this is that I didn't realize, but kind of makes sense. Thinking about what these movies were, is that the little quote that I found. With regard to some of these movies that have already been made about this genre, mentions that movies about rap often bring in the kind of big bucks that can launch careers. Notorious grossed $44 million. I didn't realize that. Hustle and Flow brought in $23 million, and 8 Mile, based on the life of Dr. Dre, protege Eminem, grossed close to. Does anybody want to guess what this made worldwide?
No idea.
Well, before you drop that number on us. I will note that through no fault of my own, I somehow saw that movie twice in the theater. Once was
in the theater.
I know. Well, and here's the thing: like, I have a soft spot for that film. Like, but I would that's a movie that like,
you saw it twice in the theater.
In the theater. Well, once was a dollar theater.
Who cares? That's a destination you went to. Doesn't matter how much you paid.
I'll buy the popcorn. No. So that movie, Ryan's dollar included, made. Anybody want to throw out a number? Just out of
I literally have no
Ryan.
I don't know. $40 million.
$243 million.
Jesus.
So like that'll float that genre for a while. Like
yeah,
but you have to do it. Like that's the interesting thing about NWA is like that you know they disbanded years and years ago, and so it'll be interesting to see what happened, but.
I do. I found the thing I wanted to read you guys.
Show us.
A couple of days ago, I was seeing this. There was some controversy about the casting call for females for the NWA. Is it biopic or biopic? I never know.
I think it's biopic. I used to say biopic, and my ex-girlfriend, English major, stick up her ass, like laughed me out of the room when I said biopic.
Oh, I used to say biopic, but then I never know. Anyway, it's
sure
irrelevant.
If we pronounce
me.
It one way, somebody on the other side of the country.
Is it like bruschetta or bruschetta that both of them are?
Well, bruschetta is technically correct.
No, they're both technically correct.
But the
correct,
common
but we're
usage
not gonna...
in America, I don't say bruschetta to people I wait on because they'll think I'm being pretentious.
Okay, this is a discussion for another time.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm gonna quote. A little bit of this. This is a little synopsis of what happened. But the casting company behind the new NWA biopic, Straight Outta Compton, received a lot of unwanted attention for a female casting call that was considered by many to be offensive and racist. Now the company's coming out to apologize for the insensitive nature of the listing. On the call sheet, the company, Sandy Alessi, explained they were looking for 4 different types of girls. And this just kind of has little sum ups, but there were A girls, B girls, C girls and D girls, and there were a lot more. They were very, very involved descriptions. A girls were listed as the hottest of the hottest and must have real hair, while B girls should be light skinned. But I mean, there were paragraphs of what they wanted. However, the D girls were listed as having to be African American, poor, and not in good shape. And they considered Beyonce to only be a B, FYI.
Oh, so was that on their rider, like Blue M&Ms? Like, was that like?
They just put the casting sheets out there. They're wanting people to come out there, and you know, it's the casting call.
Cast for the movie.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay.
Right. So they're asking. They're asking for the. No, that's pretty funny though. I just now got it. But they're saying like A, B, C, and D, and for different parts. So like, I guess you know when they're coming up and they're in the hood, they're gonna get the D girls, the poor, not in good shape women, and as they are right, meteoric rise to fame, mm-hmm. they the hottest of the hottest. And also, I think that the A girls were pretty much, it was implied that they wanted white girls.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah.
So,
nothing offensive about that.
No. If you think about it, the people were really offended, and it is offensive and incredibly misogynistic, but. We're talking about a really offensive, misogynistic group.
Maybe they're just trying to roll with the nature of their subject.
One of the reviews that I read said something that I thought was really interesting, and I think one of the things that we've all been tiptoeing around on this record is that it's hard to talk about because they intentionally write it in such a way that it's supposed to be confrontational. It's supposed to be uncomfortable. But one of the reviews that I read, and I'll just take this a little bit out of context, said that by this person's definition, the mind is a ghetto. And so in that sense, we all universally suffer. And I think that that's sort of what this guy was getting at is like this record is about like that's their anger, is their anger at their suffering, and that
What gets me is the duality of like, and this record feels real. It feels like it comes from a real place. I think the beats are great. I think the music's good. The production's phenomenal.
It comes from Compton, Ryan.
that's the real place to which I referred.
It's a magical land. The cars bounce up and down.
I will put a cap in your ass, bitch. If you don't,
will you truly do that?
Well, I'll put a metaphorical cap in your ass. What I was saying is. But they were really aware of like how this would be received, and like they could not wait to get the parental advisory sticker on there.
Oh no, that's
and they
true.
Put their own like you know explicit lyrics, you know, like and the fact that it got so much controversy and you know senators were up in arms and what have you, like it sold the most albums by any act without having any radio singles.
People want the things that they don't think that they can have.
Yeah, it was a perfect way for kids to rebel.
Especially 16-year-olds in the suburbs whose parents don't really give a shit about
and
them.
I saw that Ruthless Records came out with, 80% of this record was bought in the suburbs.
Well, and the interesting thing
is astonishing.
That I kind of wonder, and I'm sure somebody's on the record about it, but not this record, but has talked about it to a reporter.
Yeah.
I wonder how they felt about the fact that Middle America loved this record, and they didn't really necessarily write it for Middle America, I don't think. They wrote it well.
No, I think they were writing what they knew.
Yeah, sure.
But when it came to marketing and what I was talking about before, about them being astute businessmen, they absolutely wanted kids in the burbs to buy it and all that shit. They wanted it to seem dangerous.
But I'm saying initially, though, I mean, what they were writing about, I feel pretty strongly about the fact that they were writing. I mean, granted, in a self-aggrandizing form, but it was what was going on pretty
Certainly,
much in their world,
in their neighborhoods. And this is something that Kevin and I alluded to while you were in the John.
That's the bathroom.
Yeah.
In rap lingo,
the bathroom.
The outer chalice.
The ivory chalice.
Yeah.
The ivory chalice.
Exactly. Whatever.
Ceramic. Porcelain chalice.
Anyway, go ahead.
I like ivory.
Kevin and I were having a little bit of a discussion that there really, when this record came out, there seemed to be kind of two poles of thought about it and not a whole lot of in between. One of which was, this, you know, record is glorifying violence. It's making it seem cool to, you know, be misogynistic towards women. Glorifies his drug use and the sale and extreme violence, and it makes it seem, you know, cool. And then, of course, the artists and a lot of people who were, you know, inner city would say, well, no, they're just reflecting life on the streets. And to both of those, I say yes. Yes, it is that. And
yeah,
yes,
I agree
it is
with
that.
You.
And I'm certain that there are people who are now dead
that are so because, you know, maybe they really got into this lifestyle because of this record and others like it, you know, made it seem like something that was a little more glamorous and romantic than the reality of what it actually is. By the same token,
there's a lot of people that are dead because of that.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's, again, a reflection of their
But also, this is what
status.
Was going on, and it probably exacerbated upon itself. You know, like the more that happened, the more people wrote about what was going on in their own front yard.
I mean, why would you not?
Yeah. You know, it's what you know.
But again, like I said, self-aggrandizing, and I mean it. I mean, there's a lot of chest puffery, as it were, involved.
No, I think chest puffery. I mean, this is one of the albums that became that made that a staple. But I will say one quick side note. You know, one of my favorite, maybe the only Dick Cavett quote that I ever tried out there.
That was when we'd bring him out.
Yes,
in the NWA discussion,
because he has a. We all know about how much time he spent.
He's an authority,
Dr. Dre. Yeah. I would like to ask you.
No, but I mean somebody like way
pretty
way
good
back
Dick
in way back in the day. You know, I mean predating this record by easy 15 years. You know, there had something to do with. There was another violent American situation. Maybe it was the 68 Chicago Democratic Convention
or the
Watts riots or whatever. Anyway, his response to that was people were seeing the violence on TV, and there was a lot of backlash about, like, does that mean that there's going to be more violence in the street because people see an example of that? And he was like, well, okay, does that mean if we see comedy on TV that there will be comedy in the streets? Like, it's sort of just a matter. I was like, that's a really oblique, interesting way to look at that.
Certainly, I don't know.
I think it's brilliant.
It's brilliant. I don't know if it completely answers the question.
I mean, it doesn't. But that's a good question to ask.
You know, if like a iconic black leader like MLK Jr. has been assassinated and the information gets disseminated.
I love that you treat him with the appropriate respect of iconic by truncating his name from just to his initials.
I was going
to
say Marty K.
Well, at least he didn't do him like a band. Like, he's not MLK Jr. Jr. Like the that'd be a,
all right. Let's not sidebar.
Yeah. Anyway,
I think that's a brilliant quote, and what you're saying, but it doesn't truly sum it up. But I feel like a lot of times when people propose the or ask the question, is this violence perpetuating violence? Violence in movies, violence in music. Is it perpetuating violence? But that's a foregone conclusion in their minds, just by the way that they ask the question. It's not. Is it actually? Is there really a question there? They've already made up their mind that yes, in fact, it is.
Well, it seemed like just the discussion that was going on in popular media at the time. You know, in the 2 to 3 years around, you know, and after the release of this record. There were, you know, people in suits and Senate hearings who were saying, you know, this is bad for America and, you know, it's only encouraging violence. And, you know, the artists are going like, this is just my fucking life. And
that, which
yes,
is true.
Both are true.
Right. Like, right.
I mean, it's undoubtedly it helped exacerbate the problem. However, like, we got freedom of the press, freedom of speech, and you're allowed to say what you see as long as you're not in a crowded movie theater yelling fire when there is none.
It exacerbated.
But there was fire going on, and they called it out.
Right, as well they should have. I mean, far be it for us to who live nowhere near their world to tell them, like, you can't talk about the shit that you see. I mean, but it's not as though, and this I think needs to be stressed, it's not as though they were just, you know, just sitting on their porch and writing down – you know, the horrors of living in South Central Los Angeles in that time. I mean, they definitely were creating somewhat glamorous characters in the
certainly,
middle of that.
Certainly.
I mean, that can't be overlooked.
I mean, white kids in the burbs wanted to, you know, be these guys.
Life ain't nothing but bitches and money, implying we've got bitches and money.
Yeah.
And that's why you're looking up to me.
So one of the really interesting things I think about this record, we've talked in previous episodes about some of the stuff that Chuck Klosterman has put out, and one of the things that he wrote in his most recent book had to do with the fact that this record, like NWA and this particular record, came out at a really weird time for Los Angeles in terms of its culture, because it came out while the Oakland Raiders were actually relocated in L.A. Mm-hmm. And they won a championship while they were there, but they were so influential with that particular thought leading part of the fashion side of what was considered cool and like of the street, that the Los Angeles Kings, who also became big during that time because that's when Wayne Gretzky came over from Edmonton, like they started. They switched their colors.
Doesn't know that whole story.
Well, the point being is like those guys changed their colors from the Lakers colors, which were gold,
yellow and purple,
and then to the same as the Raiders, and so there was this weird sort of little aquarium window of what was going on in Los Angeles during that time and what it meant. And so basically, I guess my point is, and I think the point of the piece that Closerman put together was that it became sort of a national fashion icon that was born in Los Angeles, but it was born of stuff in Los Angeles that was kind of temporary. And mm-hmm. so he was like it at the time, it didn't feel like that. They made it feel important and angry and revolutionary, but you can't sustain.
Well,
that
and I think there's
there.
A whole 30 for 30 ESPN doc on that phenomenon.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You guys just wake me up. I'm gonna go lay down. And...
yeah.
Anyway, so I feel like that brings us to a place where,
actually, I do want to get back to what you were going to talk about, and then Kevin and I kind of touched on something while you were again in the porcelain
bathroom.
Okay, yes. Well, do we need
the ivory chalice?
Yeah,
I would like to. I'd like to. Well, soon I'd like to play. I would like to play "Fuck the Police," but
acoustically.
Yes, exactly.
As you drag out your, we just put the mics on the ground.
It's a cappella.
We'll take a break. We'll be right back with Kevin's
barbershop quartet version of
boom, 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 boom.
But I'm hearing
the police
in the mask.
Coming straight from the underground.
It's just, now I'm damaged. Anyway, all right, Shane, do you want to do your story now or after the break?
I'll do it after the break. But before we go into the song. Are we going to go to Fuck the Police? I almost can't say it now. I've got the barbershop quartet.
Have you noticed that you can't say police either? It's
you have like to say police. You know what? When you said that a second ago, in my brain, I was like, he said police, and now I just did it.
It's like the whitest man alive just said police.
Police. So I just wanted to say that I've been waiting all night. I haven't been waiting. I discovered it earlier, then I forgot, and then I rediscovered it a few minutes ago. So, I mean, it's been all night, but I haven't been waiting
get
all night.
Point,
just to
this
clarify
is
that.
Fascinating, Shane.
I know. Okay, so this is a review by Peter Clark in Hi-Fi News and Record Reviews.
Oh, God.
And his quote about in the review of this album is, "The lyrics on this record are unrelenting in their unpleasantness. The cumulative effect is like listening to an endless fight next door." Genius.
Yeah, I actually read that earlier too. Like, he hit it on the head. If you're in a bad mood,
I just imagine that you're in an apartment and the people on the other side of the wall are.
Oh, I've been in like the people in the same apartment.
Dude, did I ever tell you
I'm trying to wake up the next day? So I get that metaphor
right.
A lot.
Well, I mean, I do kind of feel like we won't go way down the rabbit hole because we're going to go to break soon. But I do feel like the difference between that view. And the view of the people who made this record or the people who really connected with this record that were in the inner cities of America was that those guys lean into the conflict because they're like, this is what I know. I can either bow up against it or it'll run me over. Mm-hmm. And that guy's just like, turn your music down.
Well, and I will say this.
Wow, like, those are two very disparate ways of looking at
that. I will say
this.
For whatever reason, I did not feel like they were yelling at me.
That's good.
I felt like they were yelling about something, but they weren't yelling at me.
That's I'm glad you brought that up. I was gonna ask you about that earlier. Thing is how your main comment on the Beastie Boys was that you feel like they're always yelling
it
at
really
you.
Really felt like they were yelling.
Well,
at
and
me.
They were always in the upper register. Do you feel like that had something to do? With
I definitely do.
I don't know. Maybe it's because they were white, but like, and that's mainly my peer group. But like, it definitely felt like they were like. I mean. I don't know. Like, they have really – the Beastie Boys, that is, have really sort of screeching voices. And
2/3 of them did. Yeah. Anyway, but that was another review. And I think – I do think that
And you guys were like, have you heard rap? And I'm like, I don't feel that way about all of it. I do feel like that about Busta Rhymes.
he is yelling at you. That all is right, correct.
Yeah. So anyway, so let's we got to go to break. They're mad at the police. Let's listen to...
Wait, I love that you're switching it even into your really white... They are mad at the police.
They're angry at the authorities, and we're going to listen to them talk about it.
And so this was pretty much...
Because they have the authority to kill a minority,
as
we'll
soon
find.
The most controversial track on the record at the time of its release and subsequent success.
What's it called?
Fuck the Police.
All right.
Tell everybody what the fuck you got to say. Police coming straight from the underground. A young nigga got it bad cause I'm brown. And not the other color, so police think they have the authority to kill a minority. Fuck that shit cause I ain't the one for a punk motherfucker with a badge and a gun to be beaten on. And thrown in jail, we can go toe to toe in the middle of a cell. Fucking with me cause I'm a teenager. With a little bit of gold and a pager. Searching my car, looking for the product. Thinking every nigga is selling narcotics. You rather see me in the pen than me and Lorenzo rolling in a Benzo. Be the police out of shape, and when I finish, bring the yellow tape to tape off the scene of the slaughter. Still getting swole off bread and water. I don't know if they fags or what. Search a nigga down and grabbing his nuts. And on the other hand, without a gun, they can't get none. But don't let it be a black and a white one, cause they'll slam you down to the street top. Black police showing out for the white cop.
All right, that was Fuck the Police.
Or what did I say? Bugger the Bobbies.
Bugger the Bobbies. And the reason that he said that is because I told him I had a little something to share from the BBC. They actually did a song-by-song breakdown of this record, which just goes to show, like, you know.
The BBC being the British Broadcasting Channel, which is also, I guess, a radio network as well.
Yeah.
And online journalism.
Pretty sure it's British Broadcasting Company, but
well, okay. Whatever it is, here's what they had
I think
to say.
You are right.
They said equal parts righteous political ire and bratty youth revolt. Fuck the police, or how would they say it?
Fuck the police. It was bugger the Bobbies.
Yes, exactly. Lashed out at the rampant mistreatment black youth in the 80s endured at the hands of Los Angeles Police Department. Ice Cube nails his mission statement at the top of the verse with the blunt force of the opening couplet. Fuck the police coming straight from the underground. A young N-I-A, they're writing, got it bad because I'm brown. The growing racial tension between the LAPD and minorities, fuck the police, speaks to and had been a blind spot in the news at the time, but things would come to a violent, bloody head a few years later during 1992's citywide L.A. riots.
I just saw for the first time in 20 years some footage of Reginald Denny getting pulled out of his truck during the L.A. riots.
It was disturbing.
It was beyond disturbing, but you know what made me feel – I never knew this before. You know, when they hit him in the head with the brick, one of his eyes was coming out of his socket, and then somebody else ran up and kicked him. And I hadn't seen that before, but what I love is that...
I hope that wasn't the part you love.
I said, but what I love is that at some point, I believe it was a woman came to his truck, got him inside his truck, and there was a large African-American gentleman right down the street who was a nurse that saw this going on and ran in the middle of all this chaos and all this violence, ran down the street to help this guy. And turns out, like, and he jumped on the truck, and there was another person in there with him who was also black, and they basically both figured out that they were both nurses who had seen him on the TV and had gone down there and, like, braved all of this chaos and insanity to help save this guy's life. And so I had never seen that before. I didn't know anything about it, but...
Thanks for bringing the room down, man.
What are you talking about? It's completely heartwarming.
No, I know. It is horrible.
It is.
I'm just trying
it's heartwarming.
No, it is heartwarming that happened.
All right, so let me get off that, and I'll tell you something funny, all right?
All right.
Let's
have actually a Reginald Denny sidebar.
Oh.
Which is just that the late, great Bill Hicks used to talk about. Like
step on the gas.
Well, yeah, that one of the staples. I mean, we won't go through the whole thing, but one of the staples of his bit was that he tied it into the California traffic law where you have to stop anytime anybody walks in the middle of the road. And he was like, you know, that was pretty much what may have gotten in Reginald Denny's way, was that people stepped in the road and he just stopped and they pulled him out of the truck. And he was like, some of you, he was like, I'm Reginald Denny. Some of you may have caught me getting my ass kicked on the news. He's like, but anyway, and it ends with him talking with his supervisor talking about what a great employee is, because he doesn't ever stop and he shows up on time or ahead of schedule.
He's the greatest employee. It's like he never stops.
It's like he ain't stopping out there. So anyway. But that circles back to what we were talking before about how Americans we're wired to sort of confront things that are sometimes really scary in ways that are funny.
Yeah, it was pretty scary. That was some scary ass shit. And to get away from that, I lived at the time that was going down in maybe the exact opposite place in the world, a town of 15,000 people. No, not geographically, moron.
Is it Kerberg?
Kerbal. A town of 15,000 in the middle of the Texas Hill Country. And I had two friends. Well, I mean, rap was everywhere, but I had two friends that were really – and this is before it exploded, right on the precipice of exploding into the mainstream everywhere. And one of them – the guy that used to take me to work every morning, Killer Tom, we've discussed before. His hat, it said Killer Tom. He got some letters pressed into it, and he always wore it cocked at an angle. I think he told me that when he lost his virginity, the only thing he didn't take off was his Killer Tom hat.
That is hard, man.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
But another guy's name was Judd, and Judd drove a van. And Judd was wider than Tom, if you can imagine. And that's pretty awesome, Kevin. Can you cock that like Killer Tom? Kevin just put on a hat that says, Ladies Wanted, Inquire Within.
And it has a styling van.
Picture of a van on it.
It's super
Speaking of
special.
Vans, Judd drove a van, by the way. And Judd, I remember the first time I ever listened, or the first time I ever remember listening to this record, Straight Outta Compton, it was while Judd's van was dying. It ran out of gas, and we were coasting into a gas station. And I was like, what is this shit? Like, all I can hear is the bass. And he's like, yeah, but I really like the lyrics. The lyrics are really deep. Quote, that is
really
deep. That's a direct fucking quote.
I won't say they're shallow either, although some of them are.
Well, and I think – but I do, again, I think that's one of those deals where that's kind of intentional.
But, however, you guys, I got to tell you one thing about
–
I've got to tell you one more thing about Judd.
Tell us.
Judd would only drink his drink of choice, and the only thing he drank again, we were in high school, but he was one of those Hesher guys that – I think he was 2 years older than me, but he looked 20 years older than me. With a wispy mustache, and he had like skinny chicken leg.
Was he into 2112?
Why? But I don't know. But probably. Rat was. Yeah. But he would only drink lemon lime Gatorade mixed with peppermint schnapps.
Good God!
And one time I asked,
"Got to be the foulest drink on the planet."
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah.
One time I asked Judd, "Well, why do you drink peppermint schnapps and?" Mixed with Gatorade. And by the way, 17-year-old me didn't question the peppermint schnapps part. But I was like, why do you mix it with Gatorade? And with a straight face, he looked at me and said, because it gets it into your bloodstream faster.
Everybody knows that.
Duh.
Science.
That was the dude that turned me on to NWA for the first time.
Well, you know, I think... Cool thing about diving into this record is, like I say, I think we've swum around in the divisiveness a little bit, but I do think that they actually, by virtue of the fact that these guys were such sort of hook masters, it became more unifying than they maybe had actually intended.
Well, the record is actually solid. Like, if you take away like the lyrical content and the controversy and the violence, the misogyny. Like, the beats are...
Those are a lot of things to take away.
Then it's 4 minutes long.
I know, but, like, I don't... I mean, replace them with not inane lyrics about something else. And you've still got a good record.
Well, and as an example, there's a track on here, and I'm not looking at the track list right now, so it escapes me, but there's a track on here that is just...
You Are My Sunshine?
Yes. That is just a backbeat. And it runs for the full length of a regular, like, you know, it's 3 or 4 minutes. But I mean, like, it's literally just an instrumental backbeat. And I was like, that's kind of like them. It's either them sort of mailing it in on that one thing because they had it, and maybe that's what it was. But it felt like this is them just sort of stripping it down to like part of their formula and what they do well.
I like the way their voices sound. I mean, I think my brain just blocks out the lyrics. I don't ever really hear the lyrics. I just hear the cadence and timbre of the voice over the beat.
Can we talk about something else, too? Because I don't know. The next time that it comes around to me, I don't necessarily know that I'm going to do anything that's in this genre. One of the things that I think is really interesting about rap groups is the way that they sort of call up who's next.
I'm dropping it to Easy.
Yeah, no, it's like,
and then it's like, hey, motherfuckers!
It's like, and it's all
that's a
like,
really good Easy, right?
Thanks, man. I do him and Dick Cavett.
Be here all week.
It's always like, and it's always like some new guy just walks into the room, like that they just happen to. It's the opposite of the Costanza moment where you drop the mic. Like they throw it to the new guy. He walks into the room. He screams at everybody, and then he says something about who he's going to throw it at, and then that person walks into the room, and it starts all over.
I've actually seen this, and as white as I am, I have been in a couple situations where I've seen sort of spontaneous rap battles, and where they're like really good at doing that on the fly. People who are accomplished at their flow and what.
There's a lot of white people that are good at that too. We keep saying like as white as we are. I mean,
it's a majority. But African-American endeavor.
Here's one thing that I think that is... forgive me for stepping on you, but I think...
I didn't... Wait a minute. That sounded extremely... as though I'm a fascist. I didn't mean it like that at all. I meant it like a multicultural thing, not, hey, dude, you know there's white people that are good at that stuff too, right?
Yeah. Yes. I saw 8 Mile twice in the theater.
In the theater twice.
Yes.
Yeah, if it ever comes on, if you're ever trying to take a nap on a Saturday afternoon and you're flipping channels and you notice that movie's on, would you watch it?
I might.
All right. That's all you need to say about that.
It's terrible. Like, I mean, it's definitely not the kind of thing that... Okay, so Kevin was researching it for... an advertising agency he was working for, and then a girl I had a little bit of a thing for that I was working with wanted to go see it. Neither time it was my idea.
But had you already gone with Kevin before?
Oh, yeah. I went the Dollar Theater thing. It was with the girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's what you had a little bit of a thing for a girl, and so you pulled out all the stops.
Took her to the Dollar Theater.
Took her to the Dollar Theater.
To see the Eminem biopic.
The Eminem.
Yeah.
We went up to the dollar store to see the Eminem.
All right, so we've got one more track to run. Do you guys want to do Gangsta Gangsta?
Yeah, let's do that.
N.W.A. is fucking up the program. And then you realize we don't care. We don't just say no. We're too busy saying yeah. About drinking straight out the 8 bottle. Do I look like a motherfucking role model to a kid looking up to me? Life ain't nothing but bitches and money. Cause I'm the type of nigga that's built to last. If you fuck with me, I put my foot in your ass. See, I don't give a fuck cause I keep belling, belling. Yo, what the fuck are they yelling?
So that was Gangsta Gangsta, and I wanted to circle back really quick to one of the things that I brought up a minute ago. We didn't actually get to it, that I thought was actually kind of interesting, and I don't know, maybe a consistent thread, which was my thing, and I mentioned this before, is that I don't necessarily always get into things that end up mainstreaming on at the same time that the American public does. And one of them was this record, and another one was in the past couple of weeks, watched a little bit of the Ken Burns Jazz thing, the documentary. And one of the things that stuck with me when I was going through this record was something in particular that was somebody was talking about Charlie Parker. And that was that what really sort of made that guy great. And I'll get to what equates to this record in a second. was that he figured out a way to sort of end on a note with each of his improvisational phrasing that landed on a note that was palatable and made sense to the ear. So it gave him a lot of like freedom to roam in between. And I feel like that's something that's really like very similar or feels analogous to this record, that the way that they like they fall, like the rhymes fall intentionally in a way that is a little bit offbeat or like on the afterbeat.
Yeah, they
designed
do that a lot,
to like
yeah.
propel you forward. So that's what I wanted to make sure I threw it.
Where a lot of the rhymes will finish in the beginning of the next verse.
Right. Yeah.
Or the next line.
And you think
yeah,
and
they just pick it up like yeah, mm-hmm. there's not a lot of gap in between.
And they're double entendres. They're like it sounds like one thing if you cut it at one point, but like when you figure it in with the whole, it sounds like something else, which is kind of cool.
Well, speaking of NWA lyrics, we haven't gotten into any of them.
Well, and the reason that Shane wanted to play Gangsta Gangsta because he finds it to be I think it's a great song, but it does have its funny moments.
I think it's hilarious, and I think that some of the best funniest lines, definitely the fun, just quote after quote after quote after quote in the song. But I'm going to go ahead and get into the first part of the second verse.
Well, and is this something that we're going to need to something we've danced around?
Oh, right. Yeah, we've had to dance around. So when I insert the word gentleman, I think
we've been dancing around the issue of the N-word, which, you know, we won't even get into the controversy surrounding that, but it's just something we're just not going to use.
Yeah, of course not. But we're not going to use the term the N-word either because, alluding to Louis C.K., when you say the N-word, it puts the real word in my brain.
Head. Yes. So we're going to get around that, and Shane's going to quote some of his favorite lyrics from Gangsta Gangsta, and he's just going to use gentlemen.
I'll use gentlemen in place.
Yeah.
All right. Gangsta Gangsta, verse
he's
2,
stretching
as done by Ice Cube.
I don't know why.
When me and my posse stepped in the house, all the punk-ass gentlemen start breaking out, because you know they know what's up. So we start looking for the bitches with the big butts, like her, but she keep crying, I got a boyfriend, bitch. Stop lying. Dumbass hooker ain't... there's just stuff I don't want to say on this. Dumbass hooker ain't nothing but a dyke. Suddenly I see some gentleman that I don't like. Walked over to him and said, what's up? The first gentleman that I saw hit him in the jaw. It's poetry.
Well, and that's the great thing about that. Like, having listened to that song a few times, is like the way that it actually falls, like the way lyrically that it falls, that's another one of those Ice Cube lyrics where he's just like, I saw a guy, I didn't like him, and I hit him in the face. Like, that's really what happened.
I love the summation.
it's the Cliff Notes version of the NWA. Like,
all right. Well, let's leave NWA straight out of Compton behind, I think.
We've gone straight out of Compton.
We'll be heading straight to... Where the hell is Pavement from?
Good question.
I'm completely
embarrassed.
They actually have a line in a song that they did off a compilation record where I can't tell if they're making fun of or attributing to R.E.M., but they say Southern boys just like you and me. I think maybe they're from... Are they?
Well, I know Stephen Malkmus has lived in Portland for a while now, but...
Portland,
Stockton, California.
Stockton, California.
Yeah.
From Compton to Stockton.
Well, Portland occasionally claims artists that are not entirely their own because they spend time there. But,
that's true.
And great city, nonetheless. But
I know he's made his home there, or off and on made his home there, at least.
But what's the record, Ryan?
Slanted and Enchanted, which I've heard some Pavement throughout the years. That's one that has just, for whatever reason, eluded me. But not,
likewise.
But no rock I critics too. Ever. Apparently seems to be universally loved by virtually every rock critic who ever penned a review. I'm reserving judgment.
I love Pavement, so I'm really looking forward to this, but I don't know that album at all.
Yeah, I don't know it either.
Summer Girl? Is that the song, the single?
Might be.
Could
we'll
be.
Certainly find it out next week. And anything you guys want to say on our way out?
This has
been. Oh wait, Shane, you're 2 weeks
babe.
From now.
What's that?
You're 2 weeks from now. Do you want to?
I am. Yeah.
Drop that bomb.
Yeah. So we're gonna go. I'm gonna go a little bit left field. Well, I'm gonna stay with the white guys. I've been doing really, really white music the last couple of weeks. I've been wanting to throw some jazz stuff in there for a while, but Ryan really doesn't like it, but we might approach that in the future. I was thinking today, I was thinking about giving you guys another torturous album.
Oh, great.
But I'm not. I'm not going to do that because we've only thus far done records from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Actually, have we even done a 90s record?
I think Slanted and Enchanted will be a 90s record.
Yeah, but I think we're only 70s and 80s.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to give you guys the Father John Misty album, Fear Fun, which I know you guys haven't heard. And I, as much as I love what I have heard, I've only heard the first half of the record because I love it so much. I never got to the last half of the record.
That's a great place to be, though. It's like being in the middle of a book that you can't put down, that you're scared to start the second half of because you don't want to finish it.
I've had it on in the background for sure, but I haven't sat there and lived with it. But this, I'm pretty sure by the time we come back to this, you guys are gonna not give me a free pass for the Bon Jovi shit, but at least it'll temper it a little bit.
You're still out of flogging for that, but that's another time.
Hey, man, you know what? You come up with some horrible record that we can make fun conversation about for an hour.
Well, I would, except for I would have to listen to it, too. I'd like to give you one that just you have to go
listen
to.
If I'm the only person that has to do this, I'm fine with that. But there's some stories out there that need telling about shitty music, and I think we're the men to tell that story.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
so coming up next, Milli Vanilli.
Well, good.
It's on my list of possibilities.
I'm in love with you, girl.
I think to be clear, like just to reiterate, one of the things that we want to do is like find the stuff that like sits on the fence, like that there are some people that love it, and maybe we just don't know it that well. And it could just be a case of the latter, like we just haven't gotten managed to intersect with that record yet, like something like...
That's certainly a bit of our mission statement. I certainly don't want to sidebar on this too much, but I have heard this artist's songs several times in the last week. Does anybody love or really hate Billy Ocean?
Get into my car.
Yeah, get out of my dream.
Get out of my dream.
I mean, I'm sure that guy packed arenas at one point, but like... Has anyone ever met anyone who's like, oh man, you got to check out my Billy Ocean collection?
There's a
like,
type of person that fancies himself a lover of women, of many women, and you know the kind of guy I'm talking about. You know this man. He speaks in low, dulcet, sultry tones, and that's the kind of music he plays when he seduces them.
Probably what it meant was that he typically parked close to his bedroom. So he's like, I wake up and then I get into my car, and if there's somebody there, then that's really terrific.
I'm certain that's it, Kevin. Yes, yeah.
That's just super.
Thank you. All right, I didn't want to drive down that road too much, but it just occurred to me like this gentleman still gets airplay, or at least on, you know.
I just heard "Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car" less than a week ago.
Yeah, but I don't think I've ever heard anybody say anything really pro or con about Billy Ocean.
Well, you don't live in those circles.
Do we want to tease the 5 minutes with feature that might be coming down the road?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So maybe next week, maybe the week after, we're going to start doing – do we decide one or two, maybe two a week?
We'll just see how it goes. But, I mean, I think what we've decided on is we want to dissect and roll around in a song the way that we – get a chance to talk about records, but on a much shorter
basis. Smaller, and we'll between 5 and 10 minutes, and we'll put them out in between episodes, the longer episodes.
Yeah.
So more on that to come, but this is definitely something
in the works.
Anyway, thanks for listening. This has been a lot of fun. This is Somebody Likes It. I'm Kevin.
I'm Ryan.
Shane.
We'll see you next time.